Welcome to TCJ Talkies, one of the podcasts paid for by the Comics Journal. This is the one hosted by me, Mike Dawson. You can follow me on Twitter, Mike_Dawes. See my work at MikeDawsonComics.com. And most importantly, check out the Kickstarter campaign that I'm currently campaigning to self-publish Kickstarter. Self-publishing a collection of my recent comic essays, and the book is going to be called Rules for Dating My Daughter. Here's from the Kickstarter page. The comics in this collection examine a wide variety of topics, from after-school pickup and Disney's Sophia the First to gun control and impending environmental collapse. Simultaneously political, philosophical, and humorous, these first-person cartoon essays all seek to answer the book's central question, Am I Good? So yeah, that's happening right now. If you go to Kickstarter, you can see the rewards that I'm offering, and the best one being the simplest one, a copy of the brand new book, signed in and drawn in by me, Mike Dawson, of MikeDawsonComics.com. Anyway, yes, sorry for the plug. Longtime listeners ought to appreciate that I rarely do these types of things on the show. You longtime listeners know this isn't some mercenary commercial undertaking. TCJ Talkies is a celebration of all things beautiful and worthwhile in the world. It is the show where cartoonists come on to talk about other cartoonists behind their backs. Today, I am excited to welcome two guests to the show, King Cat himself, John Porcellino, and returning TCJ Talkies champion, Caitlin McGurk. As I just alluded to, John Porcellino is the cartoonist behind long-running self-published mini-comic King Cat, which I think he started in 1989. He was the author of the Hospital Suite graphic novel, amongst actually a bunch of books. But most recently, the Hospital Suite, published last year by Drawn and Quarterly, and discussed by me, Mike Dawson, Annie Mock, and Chris Mukai on an episode of TCJ Talkies a couple months ago. That was a good one. We also talked about John a lot on the Silly Daddy episode. So I'm very excited to actually have him on the show now, since I've been warming up to it. Caitlin McGurk is the engagement coordinator / outreach curator at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum. She was also previously on an episode of this podcast. She discussed Dan Clough's Ghost World and the Death Ray, along with Jim Rugg, which was a good episode. It was the last episode I did before not doing the show for 8 months, but it was probably, it was an excellent one. And she was an excellent guest. That's how I asked her back.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
John, I think you're naked in your Skype default picture.
I think I am, too. I think that, like, the first time I used it, that was the joke.
That's Steph.
Is that a tattoo on your arm?
Probably. I don't know what the picture is, but yeah, I've got a couple tattoos.
It looks like the top of Nancy's head.
Yeah, I have a Nancy on my right shoulder.
Okay, in the picture, it just looks like you have a circle because you can just see the top of it. So
a really weird birthmark.
Yes, a very large mole. You guys know each other? You do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In fact, we have matching Nancy tattoos.
That's right. We're part of a very exclusive club.
It's a coven. Yeah.
You guys got them on the same night? Is that how
No.
It works?
John probably got his a very long time before I got mine, but I didn't know he had one, to be fair.
Yeah, I got mine on my 21st birthday. It was a present from a friend of mine whose boyfriend was a tattoo artist and was, like, renowned in Chicago for these amazingly intricate, super realistic tattoos, and so I got a Nancy head.
That's awesome. I got mine on my 25th birthday when I was moving away from Vermont.
Aww.
So, but it really is like a secret comics coven? Like if you,
Oh yeah.
If you get invited in, you get the Nancy tattoo?
Totally.
Yeah, it's a secret society of two.
Well, that's great. I have a Dave Cooper tattoo.
And that's cool.
No, it's not. It's the worst thing.
I do feel lucky. I only have two tattoos, and I am completely fine with them. I have no regrets. I got them when I was quite young. I have no regrets about them. So I figured I'm going to stop now. You know, I'm going to stop at two that I don't have any regrets about.
You're out.
Yes, I'm out of the game.
I only have Nancy, but the only other one I almost got was actually from the book we're going to talk about.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah.
From The Summer of Love?
No, from I Never Liked You.
You're going to get a tattoo of the forest and the girls in the forest from Summer
yeah,
of Love?
Yeah, making out on the rock. No, I almost got the... I was, like, so in love with that image of that Chester draws for Skye of the skeleton with the dove. So,
yeah.
I thought that would be pretty badass to get, like, on my leg, but I'm kind of glad that I didn't, just because I think it's cool to just only have one tattoo and have it be Nancy's face.
Yes. So,
that drawing, that's kind of a goth. That would be kind of a goth, kind of.
Yeah.
Or emo. Is it emo?
I was pretty goth and pretty emo back then. So.
Yeah, so it would have been perfect.
Yeah, totally.
I would be great if you had that as a big back piece.
God. Barf.
You could get the wings of the bird on your shoulder blades and then the skeleton on your spine.
Like reaching up from my butt.
Well,
possibly. No regrets there. What a great tattoo it would be. I guess we could just start talking about the book since we're talking about it.
Sure.
Are we recording already?
Yeah, we've been recording, but
oh, good. Yeah, because that was some golden material there.
Because that picture I think is so funny in the book. So my question: the picture of the skeleton.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say it because I guess we're jumping right into the book, but because I don't think the book has like a huge amount of sense of humor, but I do actually see that part as funny because it's sort of like it's very like is a teenager, a very sincere, like you know, but corny kind of image. Like it looks like a Led Zeppelin kind of cover to me, or like a D&D manual.
I don't know, the way he draws it, that's a pretty kick-ass drawing.
I really wonder what the actual drawing looked like, you know? I mean, because yeah. I guess it was in, like, sixth grade by that point. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out the timeline there, and then I kind of, my math skills came to the fore.
I mean, by the end of the book, like, if you read in the back of the graphic novel, by the end of the book, it's, like, the summer after he graduated high school. And it starts in, like, third grade, but then, like, two weeks later, he's a lot older. I don't know.
Yeah, he's very young with a very large head when he when it starts out.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about the book then. So we're talking about I Never Liked You first, right?
Sure.
And so I guess both you guys have probably read this book a long time ago, I'm guessing, right?
Yep.
I read it when it was coming out in the comics, and actually just recently I got a copy of it from D&Q because I didn't have any of the book form things of Chester's work. And so this was actually the first time that I sat down probably and read it all in one piece, like as a comic strip narrative is what the cover of my copy says. I don't know if this is the current edition or not.
Yeah, that's what mine says, too. And I think it's out of print. I think this is, like, the most recent one. Or all of it. I don't know.
Which one?
I'm sure.
Have you guys got, like, it's, like, the yellow one, the 2002 copy?
Yeah, it's like, tan. Yellowish tan with the blue inside cover.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if it's out of print, I'm sure Chester's just working on his notes for the new edition. Which I like his notes.
Me too.
I always support.
Know how it was for you, John, like the difference, because I didn't read this, you know, I've since seen it in mini comics form because we have them in the library, but you know, was it a drastically different reading experience reading it as a whole from reading it, you know, serialized?
Well, I mean, you know, I probably read it in the 90s or something, so I don't even remember. Was this the first autobiographical story he did in Yummy Fur, or was the Playboy first? Does anybody know?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I do remember just, like, shaking my fist at the sky when the first autobiographical Yummy Fur came out. because, you know, autobiographical comics were not that common back then, you know, and so I was doing them, and, you know, other people were. I'm not saying, like, I invented it, obviously, but it was a pretty cringy kind of thing, and then, you know, Chester started doing autobio, and I was like, oh, it's all over now.
Yeah.
nice while it lasted. And sure enough, here we are all these years later.
Huh. Do you think, was that an actual turning point, or it was just kind of in the back of your head?
Well, it was kind of, I'm kind of joking, but it really was like, I mean, like, I consciously, when I was start doing King Cat, you know, people would recommend, I've talked about this before, but people would recommend American Splendor to me. You know, they'd be like, oh, he does these similar things where, you know, there's these little short comics that aren't about anything. There's no plot or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so for years, like, I consciously avoided reading any of Harvey Pekar's comics because I, like, had this idea, like, I didn't want it to taint what I was doing or whatever. And then I guess when Chester started doing autobiography, I realized it was a hopeless cause, so I just gave in, and the floodgates of autobiographical comics opened. And but as far as the reading experience, I don't honestly remember that much except for that initial reaction to it.
Yeah,
but I mean, obviously it was incredibly different because, I mean, Chester was probably pretty prolific at the time, but even so, I would guess maybe it came out like twice a year or something.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, I think this is 4 issues or 5 issues of Yummy Fur combined. And so you're talking a couple of years worth of waiting in between issues to find out what happens next and stuff like that.
You know? Yeah.
So I will say that reading it as a rereading it now, it just struck me how great it is. I mean, I always thought his stuff was great. He's you know, a great cartoonist, but especially for something so relatively early in his career or whatever, it's pretty beautiful. You know, pretty. Startlingly good.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's great. You also have a go back with this book, right, Caitlin?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably like, you know, I haven't really categorized anything like this in a long time, but I've always said that this was actually my favorite graphic novel.
Oh, really?
It's one of those things with, like, a favorite band where you just don't even necessarily listen to it anymore, but it was such a big deal to you at a certain time. So this was the first time I've reread it in years, and it still, like, hits me, you know, really hard. And I feel like I have a connection to it for, like, some more, like, complicated reasons, because it was also at the time that I actually, like, started meeting people in comics, and I had this actually really strange interaction with Chester Brown when I was, like, 19, when
really?
I read this book.
Wait, you had a strange interaction with Chester Brown?
Yeah, I know. It's shocking. but really, it was, I could say that it was like an interaction that kind of, in some ways, maybe set me on the path that I'm on today. Like, you know, to make a super long story short, when I was a undergrad, you know, at a CW Post, Long Island University, 10 years ago, I guess, I was writing my honors dissertation on memory and consciousness in comics, and I hadn't really, you know, I wasn't part of a comics world at all. I didn't really ever go to shows or anything like that yet, but I remember tracking down Chester Brown's contact information. So, like, I don't know if this is the case anymore, but he used to not have a phone, and I think he still actively doesn't answer email or use the telephone, but I was able to get a P.O. box for him. And while I was writing this paper, and I was including a lot of stuff that I was thinking about in regards to I Never Liked You in the paper, I wrote him this, like, you know, 10-page handwritten letter just asking him all these questions and, you know, telling him what I was thinking about and about, you know, my thesis and stuff, and sent it off, you know, into the abyss and never expected to hear anything. And I think it was like 5 or 6 months later, like long after the point that I would ever even be able to incorporate any feedback he might have, I got a phone call. And
really?
And the person on the other end was like, "Oh, hello. This is Chester Brown. I got your letter."
Okay.
And I was on my way to work, and I was working at this really cool record store on Long Island that's not there anymore in Northport called Permanent Records. And even though I'm freaking out because my favorite cartoonist is on the end of the phone, because of this guilt over this new awesome job I had, I was like, "Can I call you back? I have to go to work." And then he told me that it would be a little difficult because he was calling me from a calling card, like with a calling card from a payphone.
Really?
So, amazingly, I still can't believe that this happened, but amazingly, he actually called me back later that night. Spent the rest of the workday, like, freaking out, like, you know, so angry at myself about that and thought I missed my chance.
You kicked him off the phone for your stupid job.
I know. It was a great job. But so anyway, he called me back and we talked on the phone while he was calling from a payphone.
Really?
For like an hour. And I just asked him all these questions and stuff. And of course, I didn't write anything he said down because I was like so nervous. I think I have like a piece of notebook paper in which I just wrote like, "Holy shit, Chester Brown on the other line. Holy shit." You know, like just trying to take notes, but too nervous. But anyway.
Your notes are, "I'm on the phone with Chester Brown."
Exactly.
Write down that note.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, that's a long way of saying that, like, the point of that was the impact that that had was like, oh my God, like comics are actually like a close knit world where I could get in touch with these people and I could know these people. And the fact that I had someone who I admired so much right on the phone with me, totally willing to talk to me about something, is kind of what set me up to, I don't know, try to actually get become part of the comics community, you know? So yeah, it was important.
So was he mostly answering questions about Yummy Fur? Is that what you guys were talking about? Or is
yeah.
that all sorts of questions?
It was mostly questions that I was asking him about this book in particular and some of the thoughts that I had about the way that he portrays memory and whether or not he was doing certain things intentionally. Because I don't know about you guys, but my favorite thing about the book, and I think what probably struck me the most and still strikes me the most, is the way that it's laid out. The way that you have certain pages that only have a single panel on them and kind of the messiness of the panel placement on the other pages. And then every once in a while, there's just pages that are blank altogether. And that has a really huge effect on the reading experience for me, as far as how I'm interpreting things and sort of remembering things at the same time as him, you know?
Yeah, I think that that was, you know, when he started doing the autobio stuff, that's when he started doing where he, instead of actually like laying out a page of comics and inking panel by panel by panel, he would do each panel individually on a separate piece of paper so that he could easily edit, you know, or like if he had to add stuff in between panels or cut stuff out.
Yeah.
And it allowed him really to play with the way the pages were laid out. And so you could have those things where you turn the page and there's just this single panel or, you know,
yeah.
Which I don't know how many people work that way because it's a pretty brilliant way of doing things. But,
yeah,
you know, I remember actually people complaining like, "It's a ripoff. There's only like one drawing on this page. It's all black." You know?
That's what you're buying your comics for. You want to get pounds per ink. Like
that's right. That's right.
I didn't get enough ink on this page. Although I guess it's all black, so you get plenty of ink.
Yeah, you got all that. You got ended up getting all the ink on your fingers.
I mean, I definitely have. I would agree. I had like a. Reading a comic laid out this way was a very new thing for me at the time. Like, you know, panels, like, you know, not in like in a tight grid, not filling the whole page. And,
yeah.
And I think you're right. Like, it sort of does sort of like lend itself to like the idea of memory because especially, you know, like when like there'll be like little moments, like one page will just have one panel of something and then you turn the page and it will be something else. Like it really sort of skips like around a lot.
Yeah.
Not so much chronologically, but it just sort of like goes from like point, like scene to scene.
Sure.
Yeah, and a lot of what I love too about that is that, you know, some of those scenes are, you know, it's not so much that they have the poetic nothing's really going on but there's a lot going on thing, but more so that it's like, you know how just generally, at least I have this experience, we tend to like have weird little slideshow snippets of memories that are seemingly totally useless from our youth. Like you remember putting something on a shelf or like looking at someone a certain way or something, you know, just these like vague kind of disconnected things. And a lot of these little vignettes in here are like that, where he's just like reaching for crackers or something.
Yeah, what struck me reading it again was how those little nuances that you can tell were just these kind of brief, probably seeming, you know, insignificant, maybe even to Chester's experience, except that for some reason they stuck with him. These little, you know, asides and the little actions that he goes through, you know, reaching up and taking the crackers out of the cabinet, or there were so many subtleties in this comic that I kept noticing that were really human, you know, just really beautiful, that it occurred to me that, like, in order to make a comic like this, you have to be enormously sensitive and enormously perceptive.
Yeah.
He's reaching back X number of years to pull out these kind of really intricately beautiful movements between people, or, you know, there's a one of the scenes where he's sitting in the library at school and the two girls come up to him and they're like, what are you reading? And he just holds the book up. And so they can see the cover. And I thought that was a really beautiful little moment, because he's at once he's like pretty self-assured, you know, like there's a confidence there in what he's doing and the way he presents himself, mm-hmm. but obviously also a tremendous amount of like interpersonal insecurity and those little moments like that, I just, you know, they just were very moving.
Yeah, I don't know many other works that have done it like this, you know? I mean, one of the things I like in general about comics' ability to portray memory is how, you know, memory doesn't really, memory's more like a photograph than a moving image, and it's more like, you know, a caption than you don't remember, like, an entire monologue of what some speech your grandfather gave you or something. So I just love the way that he uses the most minimal conversation and text possible to capture these tiny things, and even the images are so, you know, they're not very detailed whatsoever. It's just, yeah, it's really perfect. And one scene that I like the most with, you know, just kind of a random interaction is towards the beginning when he's sledding with the younger girl.
Yeah, it's on like page 19. He takes like a little ride with she's the younger sister of one of his neighbors.
Yeah.
Connie,
just,
right?
Those three panels kill me, especially the "you can't ride with anyone else, okay?" Just like, because it doesn't go anywhere after that, you know? But it's so completely something that is actually absurd as an adult to think about, but something that children say to each other, you know? That weird kind of...
It's a nice one there, too, because he's interacting and, like, there's no, like, regret in that little sequence.
Yeah.
Like, I find as a reader a lot of the book, I'm sort of frustrated at the Chester Brown character, you know, for the things he doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it seems like so many of the interactions you as a reader, and then I assume, partially him as a writer, like, it's sort of, you know, you want him to behave differently. So there aren't a lot of moments, but there are some in the book where it's just, like, a nice little thing where, like, people are getting along with each other, you know, like, they just are interacting non-negatively. Not yeah. like the whole thing's negative, but, you know, there's no, you know, that is a nice little sequence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, frustration was a lot of what I have, because, I mean, he never will say to his mother how, you know, that he loves her. He won't, you know, then there's the scenes with the girls, as he, you know, and his relationships with them, when he won't, you know, he won't properly date Skylar's next-door neighbor, and he won't sit with the girl. Was it Carrie, the older girl?
Bonnie is the older one.
Bonnie's the older one. Carrie's the younger one. Carrie's the one he sleds with. The little girl has a crush on him. I did actually think, as I was rereading for this, I didn't see the eating the sleeve of crackers as like sort of an unrelated detail. I actually sort of see that as like having a little bit to do with what he talks about as himself being a person who doesn't like things he doesn't know.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
because I don't know if you guys, I'd ever would snack on just like a sleeve of saltines, and he sort of shows himself doing it through the years.
Yeah.
It's a comfort for him.
You know, and it's very, like, it's very sort of bland, like, you know, kind of food.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, what else? What else? So what's the story in this?
My other reaction, I suppose, reading it now with all the years intervening and seeing the work he's done since these days, is that when you're talking about like the frustration you felt, his inability to tell his mom that he loves her, or, you know, his inability really to express, to open up to these different women throughout his life, is pretty fascinating when you put that in context with something like paying for it or some of the work he's done. You know, and I mean, this is a real example, I think, of one of the remarkable things about autobiographical art is that, you know, take this book and put it next to Paying for It, which is what? It's like 20 years in between or something.
Yeah.
And it's the same guy, and he's got the same hang-ups and the, you know, you could sit and analyze it or whatever, and I'm not here to do that, but that was striking to me too, was like rereading this book kind of, and I know Chester a little bit more as a person now, besides reading his work, and it was like, oh, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is kind of what he is, or where he came from, or these are some of these really deep-seated aspects of his personality that, when you think about it that way, you can see creeping up in decisions that he made later, both in his life, but artistically and things like that, too. And so, like, that's really pretty rewarding to me as a comics reader, is to be able to have that kind of relationship with somebody's work, where you can start to make those kind of deeper connections.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Man, I just like grabbed my copy of Paying for It. It's so interesting to see how dramatically the drawing style changes, but also doesn't really at all. It's just really him that changes in it.
Well, I did. That was one thing too that I noticed. There's so many, not that his current drawing style isn't beautiful, because it's very effective and well done, but like there's so many little, just beautiful drawings in I Never Liked You, and there's a lightness to them. You know, the cross hatching and shading can be pretty delicate. There's a, in my version, it's page 61, and it's, Chester goes to visit Carrie, and her sister's standing, you know, and it's like her profile, and behind her is Carrie in the doorway, this beautifully drawn girl, but, I mean, that drawing of Connie there, That's a pretty remarkable drawing. That's pretty amazing. And there were just a lot of little moments like that where he captured the nuances of these people. You know, there's really a lot of attentiveness.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess that's what I meant when I said it earlier too. Like, in order to make a book, you have to be very perceptive. A book like this. He's kind of in an interior world, but he's noticing everything that's going on around him, and he's storing it away, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think it's weird as a reader, because you sort of talked about, like, the movement, like, in paying for it towards, like, you know, it's a much more sort of, it's not like this, it's not open, it's much more, like, boxed in. It's, you know, the panels are all very, like, postage stamp size things, and they're really just, like, getting the bare minimum of information across. Like, and I like this sort of stuff in I Never Liked You. Like, it just sort of, like, to me, breathes, you know, in such a nice way. And I kind of, like, is it weird to sort of wish that someone would go back to that kind of thing? Or is it better, you think, to just sort of follow a person where they want to go? Like,
well, I mean, I'm sure everybody is like, oh, you know, your favorite band puts out a clunker of an album or something. You're like, what are they doing? But, I mean, for me, as a reader or as somebody taking in art, I mean, that's what, when I find an artist that really resonates with me, then it becomes this kind of adventure of following that artist where they go and seeing where it takes me. And you know, to a certain extent, that's kind of what I felt, what I was saying earlier, where reading this earlier work in the context of what he did later is pretty enlightening. And so, like you were saying, you're frustrated with the way he acts or the things he does or doesn't do. Like, I wouldn't say I feel frustrated. I kind of wish, like, he would be able to tell his mom he loves her.
Yeah.
But the overall context of his work as a whole, that becomes incredibly resonant, right?
Yeah.
You know, and, like, so it's not so much like I wish they would change, but just that the change itself becomes compelling, you know? Not that I wish they would change back, but that the change in the process of moving through their life and producing this art consistently that we have access to, that itself becomes compelling. Like at a certain point, there's certain artists like, you know, I don't know, Pete Townsend or something. Like, I don't love everything that he's done, but I want to listen to everything he's done, and I want to engage with everything he's done because I find him so interesting as an artist that I want to grapple with those other parts of him, of his creativity, that maybe it's not so personally resonant or whatever, but he's taking me to different places and forcing me to think about these things, you know, think about what he's expressing in different contexts.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge part of what I think art is all about.
Yeah. And I think even just in beyond that too, it's, you know, I totally get the I think maybe it's just like sharing the frustration that he feels probably of not fulfilling these things, which is the entire point of like the whole book. And it's, again, really perceptive and amazing how he ties all of those really simple situations and relationships all together with something like what happened with his mom, you know, and how that all represents the entire thing, you know, of this unfulfilled kind of, you know, hopeless interactions with women. But, you know, it's not that I necessarily want him to fulfill them anyway, you know? And that's why I think it's so perfect, is that, like, nothing is fulfilled in any of it, but it so perfectly encapsulates how
actual life is at that
You guys shouldn't get me wrong. Like, I'm not saying the frustration is at Chester. It's actually more like, I would think, like, adolescence specifically being in a point at which when you're an adult writing about adolescence, you're probably aware of your own frustrations for the things you've done and said, because that's definitely a period in your life where you act and say things that you probably regret later.
Yeah, you know,
and I think that Chester Brown was well aware of all that as he's writing it. Like, so I'm not frustrated at him. I think it's given me that feeling of frustration. Like, you know, the way that teenagers act, because they don't know yet, like, you know, how to, you know. Although that's also very interesting about Chester Brown, because you're right, as you go forward with paying for it, it's not like he then learns how to open up and, you know, like, you know.
It's just like how he is.
It is sort of just how he is, and, like, that is interesting to, you know, this isn't, like, just some teenage memoir, you know, which actually, because I'm going to talk a little bit about Summer of Love, which I don't think is just some teenage memoir, but it's not necessarily about, like, the cartoonist on that, Debbie Dreschler. We don't know, like, you know, what the books are that she would make now if she was making books, and sort of pushing that those same personality traits forward in the same way that Paying For It did.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to stay on Paying For It? I'm not Paying For It. Never Liked You, or sort of talk about both?
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about both. I think there's a lot of interesting parallels and, you know, divergencies between the two of them. I mean, they're both coming of age stories, right? And they're both from, I don't know the exact date, but approximately the same time.
I think, Summer.
I mean, not the setting, but when they were being produced, coming out in the mid-90s or so, or early to mid-90s.
Yeah, I think I think the Debbie Dreschler comics are a little bit later, because I was actually reading them when they came out, and I wasn't getting Yummy Fur. I think I'd missed the boat on that. Like,
It's late 90s.
Yeah, this collection, I Never Liked You, the one I have is the 1994 one, and, like, it had just sort of come out somewhere around there.
Right. Yeah, somebody say something smart and I'll respond.
Oh, that's your guys' job.
I'm curious about, you know, like, I really liked this book. I think I only had, like, read it partially a really, really long time ago, and then I hadn't read it in full until the other day, getting ready for this podcast. And I feel like a lot of the stuff in Summer of Love resonates with me almost more so than the Chester Brown book in a actual real life experience kind of way. I'd be interested to hear, you know, I don't want to make this like a gender thing, but the differences between, for you guys, of reading a coming of age story like Chester's versus Debbie's.
Well, I mean, I could relate as somebody who was pretty withdrawn as a teenager. You know, I felt very socially inept, and I kept myself to a large degree, and you know, a couple of things that I noticed were that Chester's book is pretty interior. Like, there's a lot of silent panels. There's a lot of space around everything.
Yeah.
In Summer of Love, it's very dialogue driven.
Yeah.
So even though she is experiencing this kind of inner turmoil and confusion and stuff, it's kind of expressed. You know, she's either talking to her friends, or she's kind of talking out loud to herself in a room or whatever. Whereas, you know, Chester's stuff, even though they're both with kind of withdrawn people, Chester's stuff is so, like, deeply held within, you know, that it's almost like there aren't words to put there. It's just the experience of this thing. But, you know, I when you talk about teenagers and stuff, I had that same feeling in reading both of them, how you just want to be like, you know, You can see their insecurity on the page, and it's painful to watch. know, but it's painful because I remember so strongly that feeling, and there's so many scenes in, I probably screwed up, but I reread Daddy's Girl as well, because after I read reread Summer of Love recently, so I might get some of them conflated. But there were so many scenes in Debbie's stuff where it's like, I said this thing. Why did I say this thing?
Yeah.
You know, now I've ruined everything.
Yeah.
You know, I might as well, blah, 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 blah. And then waiting around for, like, proof that she didn't destroy everything with this offhand thing or misunderstood reaction.
Yeah.
And just the weight of that insecurity, that constant insecurity of you trying to be cool, but not feeling cool at all, or trying to be smart and not feeling smart at all.
Yeah.
Trying to feel accepted, but not be accepted, but not feeling accepted at all.
Yeah.
I mean, just what a nightmare.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they're both, they both portray all of that so accurately. I love the way that Debbie Dresler does I feel like her body language is on point.
It's amazing.
And that's what, like, really drives it for me. Even for, I'm looking at page 103 again. I don't know if we have the same copies, but, like, everything about the way that she moves and sits and everything in this is, like, so painfully accurate to the way that you hold yourself at that age, like, loaded down with insecurity.
Oh, yeah.
And her relationships, and this is something that just doesn't come up as much in Chester Brown's book, but the interactions with her friends I'm really fascinated by and definitely resonate a lot with me. Like, weird, unspoken kind of, you know.
Yeah, she's fights. Yeah.
You know, the fights that you have that aren't actual fights, and when someone stops liking you, but you know, not actually said, and, yeah, I don't know. Brings back a lot.
Yeah, it brings back a lot of awful memories.
Yeah, totally.
go ahead.
I was going to say, I always felt like two things with, like, the way that she draws. One was, like, back when I first got this series, I loved the way that the two colors work together.
Yeah.
And I felt like she did such a great job with clothes. Like,
the clothes are amazing.
Yeah. Using, like,
And the hairstyles.
So how's it done? Like, it's two inks, right? Like, and so it's making three colors. And I know that in the original series, it was like a warmer sort of reddish brown and a bit more of an orange. And then in the version I have now, the hardcover, is like this very sort of like green and purple. I'm not sure what you guys were looking at.
Yeah, I've got a paperback edition that is like a real muted green and like almost a rusty red.
Yeah, that's what I have.
Reddish.
Three different colors. Okay, yeah. Because I have the hardcover when that green is like really bright and hot and like it almost looks like a 3D book.
Oh, yeah, no, the green in mine is almost like an olive green, but it's a little more subtle than that.
Yeah.
I think they're both really good. When you're talking about the body language and stuff, there was one of the scenes that I just, like, smiled to myself was in I Never Liked You, when I guess it's Carrie is trying to get Chester to show his muscle.
Yeah.
and she just, like, he's sitting on the floor next to her, and she's sitting in, like, an easy chair, and she leans over, and, like, you can tell she just, like, nudged him with her foot, like, go ahead, do it. And it's just, it's those little things that make it so beautiful. But I loved Summer. I mean, I loved this stuff when it came out. And again, same thing with Chester's book. I hadn't really, even though I picked up this copy, I think, at Big Brain in Minneapolis a few years ago. But I just had the original issues of Nowhere. So this was the first time that I read this in book form as well. And it, like I said, it made me go and pull out Daddy's Girl. And, you know, her stuff is a little bit different because, you know, I think it's clearly autobiographical, but she also is really clear in interviews and stuff that she takes liberties with the stories. And, mm-hmm. you know, the characters have different names, you know, than like the character is not Debbie in this book. It's Lily, but it's clearly her, you know, stand-in or whatever. And you know, kind of the same thing with Chester's work. It, you know, she's different because she's got these two collections and that's it. And we're all, you know, chances are that's all we're ever going to get from her in terms of comics.
Yeah.
But it did make me want to pull that one out and read it in the context of this other story. And, you know, like I said, I think that's part of the reason I like autobiographical comics or, autobiography in general is because it allows you to get this sense of a person over time. And, you know, even though Debbie's two books are based around the same, roughly the same time period, you know, adolescence, high school or whatever, there are two different, really different takes on it, the approaches and things like that. And so it was rewarding to read them both kind of back to back, and it gives you a little bit more to think about.
Yeah. I haven't read Daddy Girl, so I can't say much to that one. Have you, Mike?
I have read it years ago, and I didn't reread it when I didn't reread it, but it's much more difficult, right? I mean, it's a very
well, yeah. I mean, yeah. There's, I mean, there's, I don't know if we should let people know, but you know, there's a main part of that book is sexual assault, incestuous sexual assault, and clearly, and it becomes, even though there's less of the like really graphic depiction of it than I had remembered from earlier readings, but the way it winds throughout all the other stories, which are, you know, a lot of them are just like teenage high school stories and stuff, but it's clearly this thread that runs through all of it.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think there's any inkling of it in Summer of Love.
No, not really.
I was trying to figure out the timelines and stuff, and I don't know if it's even really possible with her work, because she's clearly taken some liberties with the storytelling in terms of, you know, probably combining things or stretching things out. So I'm not really sure. In Daddy's Girl, she talks about having to move, and I can't tell if she's moving to the place where the events in Summer of Love take place, or she's moving away from where the events take place. But I don't know. I was trying to piece it together, and I wasn't totally successful.
In this one, like, it doesn't come through. It's sort of interesting what you talk about, because you talk about with Chester how you sort of build a body of work and sort of, you know, things add onto each other. And so I didn't reread Daddy's Girl for this, and I hadn't read it in a long time. So reading this, a lot of that sort of stuff is definitely not coming through on just like a straight reading of Summer of Love. The dad is pretty like absentee, you know, from the story, which is kind of funny because it's kind of the same thing in I Never Liked You.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
The dads just aren't really there. Except for, like, right. I was one scene where, like, Chester's tormenting his mother and making her cry before they go to church. And you see, the dad sitting in the car. He looks like the dad, like, you know, that scene in Boogie Nights.
Or when his mom is, like, laying on him and asking Chester if he loves... It's like, the whole thing is just so detached. And that scene is very painful. I mean, for obvious reasons. And the scene when... they're like laying around watching TV, and the dad is in the scene, and his mom's like laying on her, but he's just like, you know, kind of lifeless, and she's asking, you know, Chester about if he loves her or not. Man, I do and I don't really want to know exactly what happened with the mom, because it's pretty confusing at the end. But
I mean, but the dad, because the dad has no sort of agent. No, I don't know if agency is the right word, but like, there are no scenes in either book where the father, you know, is really communicating much with the child.
No.
You know, they're both seen like around, like they're both there.
And
but yeah. but you know, there's not much like where the father's talking to Chester about anything, and that's obviously Chester's choice to not include anything.
Yeah.
With the father. But it's, and then both books also have these mothers who are you know, these children make them crazy. You know.
Sure.
And you sort of see them having to sort of bear the brunt of, like, sort of, you know, relating to the child. But I guess, yeah, it's both authors are kind of writing about the mothers a bit more. Obviously, Chester far more. Because it's kind of like, I think, what the book is a lot about. His, you know, his memories of his mother. His mother, you know, gets sick and she passes away at the end of the book. Yeah. So it's obviously a very significant moment in time, you know, for Chester.
Yeah, but being able to, for both of them, and this is, maybe I'm wrong, but being that I haven't read Daddy's Girl, I would assume that it's the dad who is the problem in that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Okay. I just think it's remarkable between Chester being able to just make the decision to remove his dad from any significance in the story, even though I'm sure he had more of one, and Debbie to remove it for this story is... It's just amazing to me, especially for that traumatic of a relationship, you know, for something that's autobiographical to be able to take that aspect out of it completely and focus on a different part of it. But.
Well, I do believe Daddy's Girl was first. Daddy's Girl out first. And so, you know, maybe she felt like she had
exhausted that. Or
yeah. She had done what she wanted to do regarding that. But, yeah, it was interesting and you know, it definitely made me want to pull that book down, and I avoided rereading Daddy's Girl because I remember, you know, it's pretty upsetting subject matter, but it's just beautifully done. I mean, just, you know, the high school moments, and it's a completely different, well, very different drawing style because it's done in ink and, you know, like pen and ink. And there's a lot of, you know, I think just the way Summer of Love was done with the two colors, with the tones, it's brushier, right? You know, it's like, it's a lot of...
Well, the other thing I was going to say about, like, the way she's, like, it's drawn... I always felt like it does a good job of creating these spaces that are both like claustrophobic, like, because it shows a lot of like these like very like dense patterns, like the forests and like the, you know, the patterns on like furniture, like, yeah, sort of like it's very like it really fills out every panel. In fact, some panels, like, you know, like, yeah, like they get very like claustrophobic, but it also seems like a very empty place. You know, you see a lot of like, you know, empty lawns, you know, the houses are all very sort of, you know, there's a sort of a generic emptiness to like a lot to where they are. I mean, the original series is called Nowhere, and I thought it was kind of a good name for the book, because it sort of feels that way. Like, you know, this is like a town that has no character that comes through in the story. It's not like one of these books where, like, that, you know, I guess the town is the character in like its generic and sort of emptiness, but it's not like, oh, like that specific place that, you know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. And I think that relate, you know, both books are like that completely, which I think just adds to that, you know, youthful element of it being a really kind of isolated your entire world moment for incidents and relationships and things that aren't, you know, from the outside perspective, necessarily as dramatic as they just feel, you know, in that really intimate environment for just that person.
Yeah. You'd ask the question sort of like about like how, like what our readings were of the books in terms of our gender and stuff like that.
Yeah, and in general.
It did want to make me bring up this, the one, like a part I always loved about I Never Liked You, which is just that two-page scene with the centerfold. Well, it's very funny. Like, because I do think that this book has got like funny parts.
Yeah.
Like, sure. It tells you a lot with a very minimal amount of cartooning.
Yeah. Because
unlike the Playboy, this is like a book about a teenage boy that has very little to do with, like, you know, his like his masturbation and all sorts of stuff like that, you know? Like, it's, you know, he's obviously, it's about his relationships, but it's not like, pornography doesn't play a large role in it. But you know, like, you know, so the way the two-page sequence works is that just in the middle of a scene, actually it's the scene right after his mother tells him to not take the Lord's name in vain. It's just a page of a Playboy centerfold, which we as a reader, we know what that is. We assume it's his because he's a teenager. Mm-hmm. He's a teenage boy. And then I like how just sort of like you turn the page and you use the language of the cartoon. And he tells you a lot about like what he's thinking about, you know, the girl next door. And he imagines her, you know, naked. But you don't see him doing it. You just see that bubble, the thought bubble.
Yeah.
That sort of, you know, and puts her face on the body of the Playboy centerfold.
Yeah.
And it never sort of comes up again. But, you know,
it just says a lot. I mean, that little two-drawing transition or two-drawing juxtaposition of those two things tells you everything you need to know about his thoughts about her, you know, and so it's stated, and then everything from that point on, when you see that character, you know, when you see Sky, your perception of her has changed because you understand Chester's perception of her.
Yeah.
You know?
And it goes right into that in those next two pages, which I think are like two of some of the greatest like pages of drawings in the book, you know,
where he's wrestling with Sky.
Oh yeah.
Next door,
yeah.
And she sort of pins him down.
Everything about that and just the way that he's so delicately but like perfectly renders, like, I mean, her body type in it and the things that the way that he's drawing her body in it, and it's just, yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, that's the thing, I think, because I did an episode a long time ago on Ed the Happy Clown, and it always does just reminds me that he's very good at cartooning, like bodies and movement and like saying a lot, and so I know it's uncool of me to be like, come on, do it again. That's how I feel.
Maybe he will next. I don't know. I don't know what he's working on.
I think he listens to this. He won't be able to listen to this. He'll have to use a calling card to call into the podcast.
Yeah, you're in luck. You can't ever hear this.
One thing that I noticed in The Summer of Love that I don't know if it'd be interesting to anybody else, but when you're talking about patterns and stuff, it reminded me of it. And also the coloring and stuff, which, you know, I'm not sure. I was thinking about it, and I was wondering, I wonder if this was like still like Ruby Lith that people were, that she was cutting, or was this possibly like was the coloring done digitally? Because I know that Debbie Dreschler in her illustration work, she mostly drew digitally and stuff. And it occurred to me when we were talking about how great the clothes are and stuff, like all the patterns on the clothes are all digitally rendered. So they're like...
Yeah, that's true. I was... Yeah.
You know, if there's little flowers, like the blouse she's wearing or something has little flowers, they're patterns that are clearly like cut and paste, digitally made patterns. Everything else in it is hand drawn. That's really neither here nor there, except I was thinking about it in terms of the way comics have changed so much because of people's access to digital manipulation, to working in Photoshop or whatever. And, you know, this was probably right on the cusp there where, you know, she may have been an early adopter is what I'm saying. Of
you think
like
she might have done it in Photoshop?
Well, I don't even know if Photoshop existed then, but some kind of, you know, I read an interview where she used Illustrator for a lot of her stuff. But clearly there's like really subtle parts of this book that she had some kind of digital.
Yeah, that's true. Especially things like there are certain scenes where they show her and that guy like on the couch and stuff, and just in their house, there's like four different patterns going on that, I mean, like I would think that they were like Zip-A-Tone or something, or even like in a few of the scenes in their house, looking at the wallpaper, looks like it has to be digitally rendered.
But I do feel it does.
A lot of the patterns do kind of look like lino cut pattern.
Yeah.
That you could cut and paste down, or you know, but I don't know what it is, but that was one thing that I just noticed when I was digging through here and like looking at the coloring and looking at the production of it and wondering, you know, like how this was made. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I do think I feel like some of it, like I think about like certain parts, like where you see the folds in the clothes, and it's like, so say half the body will sort of be shaded in sort of the way mm-hmm. the two colors sit on each other. To me, like when I first read it, and like that was like a type of comic I hadn't looked at before, like a comic that was produced this way, which is actually probably more common to see now, that digital, like
the
comics on the web and sort of experiment so much more with color. And I actually sort of wonder if like maybe the thing with the printing colors being all different colors in every edition was like them trying to figure something out that, like, you know, maybe the technology wasn't quite there yet.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. I'd be curious to.
But some of it does look to me, and could obviously definitely be wrong, but it always did look to me like some of it had been like cut with an X-Acto.
Yeah.
Sort of the way the curves are, and it looks a little different than like maybe the drawing line, like the figures. And I can imagine that's a lot of work. With your little X-Acto blade cutting out that red ruby lith.
Mm-hmm. This is... It would be a tremendous amount of work. Now I'm really curious. I'm going to have to find somebody who knows and find out the truth about the production of this book.
Yeah.
One other thing that I thought about that is probably going to make me sound like an old man, and it's not like there aren't like groundbreaking things happening in comics nowadays. But these two things, I mean, this was a period in comics where, like, I just remember, like, it was, like, being astounded over and over again. You'd, like, get the new 8-ball or whatever, and all of a sudden Dan Klaus is doing these stories like Blue Italian Shit and all that, you know, these, like, really just nuanced, like, incredibly smart short stories in comics form. And you'd be like, this is the greatest comic I've ever read. I can't believe anybody pulled off something this, you know, subtle and beautiful and nuanced. And then, you know, the next issue would come out and be even better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was the same kind of thing with Chester's stuff, which, you know, Ed the Happy Clown is great. You know, it's a great thing, but... All of a sudden, then all of a sudden, he starts doing this kind of stuff, and it's like, oh my god! You know, it's so good. Like people were making such enormous strides so rapidly.
Yeah.
At that time, and you know, I think about that when we're talking about Debbie's book too, where it's just like, you know, trying to figure out just how they did it. Like, how did you make this art? You know, how did you print this? How did you lay this book out? It's just, I don't know. I thought it was a real interesting combination of two books because I think there's a lot intertwined there. But that was one of the other things I thought about rereading them was just like, wow, like that was a pretty good time for comics.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, you know, with the exception of you, John, I don't know a lot of people who right now or, you know, new generation people that are even making like serialized stories like ones like this, you know? Yeah. It's actually really difficult for me to imagine reading the I Never Liked You story in Yummy Fur. You know, because it is so slow and there's that space between it that, I mean, it's slow even reading it as a graphic novel that I can't imagine taking the time between over a course of 4 years to read that story. And I mean, maybe that just says something about the way that readers have changed as well as artists, you know, that I can't even imagine someone producing something quite like this right now.
Well, I mean... I think that was part of the problem with that that stuff back. And I think it's one of the reasons, maybe, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. Some of them were good for comics, and some of them I think were bad for comics. But the reason that you don't see Yummy Fur anymore, you know, was because to do a story like that, this, in that format, you know, when with the consideration that this isn't some monthly comic that, you know, every 4 weeks you're going to go to the comic shop and there's going to be the next installment of I Never Liked You or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember what it was, but I'm sure it was tops 3 issues a year, maybe. You know, so maybe 4 to 6 months in between issues, and then trying to, like, maintain, you know, like, oh yeah, I got to get this new one, and then sit down and try and remember what happened, and maybe you reread the, you know, you must reread the early ones. It's so long ago that I can't remember how I approached it, you know. But, you know, that kind of thing probably was kind of dissatisfying to it for a person like Chester who has this story, you know. On the other hand, it gave him a chance to publish over time and make a little bit of money and keep going and get the next issue out and stuff.
I think you're right a little bit about readers changing too, like, even because I can see it in myself. Like,
yeah.
Because another person I haven't talked about much on the show before is Seth. And
there's a glacial pace.
But the thing is, like, I find it too frustrating now. Like, and he's probably one of the only people doing that. Like, probably one of them, right? Like, still serializing a story very slowly.
Yeah.
And now I sort of have that mentality, like, he'll finish this someday, then I'll read it. Like,
yeah, then I'll buy the omnibus. Like,
I did that with X'd Out. Like, when X'd Out came out 3 years ago or whatever it was, I picked it up and I was like, this is so exciting to me. And it was the first time in a really long time that I had that feeling of, like, I cannot wait to find out what happens next, and I'm going to have to wait for the next installment of this thing. And I think it was, like, you know, now, you know, everybody knew it was going to be a 3-part series or whatever. It's just like, and I did end up, you know, the next two that came out, I got them and I just put them on the shelf next to X Out, or, you know, I waited the second one. I did that. And then when the third installment came out and I knew the whole story was there, I started over at the beginning again with X Out and I read them all through. So, like, I kept my hand, I didn't even crack the second one because I was like, I don't want to see what happens until I can read the whole thing.
Totally.
So, yeah.
I feel like people have the patience they probably used to have with this stuff.
Sure.
I think that might be true.
Yeah, I'm sure it is to a certain extent.
When I was in college, I was a painting major, but I didn't really want to paint. It's just sort of like I had to pick something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was definitely one of these people who, like, was trying to make comics in my artwork, like, you know, no matter what, you know, despite all the teachers being like, why don't you stop doing this? And so I was doing all these paintings where I'd take a panel of, like, from a superhero comic and I'd crop it so the heads and, like, arms and legs were cut off of the figure and it was just, like, the crotch. And it was, like, supposed to be a joke about, like, you know, the sexual, like, you know, the sexual subtext of, like, these superhero comics, like, all these big bulging, like, you know.
Yeah.
Men in men's underwear, and my parents have them hanging up in their house. It's the weirdest thing, because I think this happens a lot. Like, of people, like, their parents hang up the artwork they made in college, and, you know, like, that's strange. But anyway, I did one from nowhere, where I tried to, like, take something that wasn't like a Marvel or DC thing and, like, paint a sexual scene.
Wow!
Like an underground comic. So I took this panel where it's Lily in the woods and her sister is making out behind her.
Yeah.
On the rock, and I have to say, it took so long to paint this stupid background, like all those leaves and let's get the two different tones. Looks like crap. Just referring to, like, what you're talking to before about, like, you know, the kind of work that's in there. It doesn't. The painting doesn't really work as well because it's not really funny. In the same way.
Sure.
It was like, you know, like a big, like, hanging up in my living room is like a big Thor crotch.
Now that's funny.
It is funny. It just fills the space up so well. It makes sense in my house. It's weird in my parents' house. Yeah, I just wanted to bring up that little anecdote.
Because
I just remember, well, I was just a bad student too, so like, you know, it was, you know, the superhero stuff was much easier because it's just flat areas of color, look much more like a pop art painting.
Yeah.
Whereas like trying to fill in all the patterns that the Debbie Dreschler comic had was like, that's why I only did one of those.
Yeah. I would love to know how big her original art is, that, like how she drew this stuff.
So she's like, she's done with comics. She said that, right? Like,
I don't, John, you would know. I don't know.
Well, I tried to figure out a little bit about it when I was allegedly preparing. I'm using air quotes for this talk.
You're a D&Q insider.
I remember reading at some point that, because she had multiple chemical sensitivity, so she was like having allergic reactions to the materials she was using to make art. And I can't remember at what point that was, if it was while she was making these comics, or maybe if that was a reason that she switched from comics making to more pure illustration and stuff. But I think I have both editions of Daddy's Girl, and in the new one, in the back, there's a little note, and it basically says, you know, I've told all the stories. I loved making these comics, and it was a special thing for me to do, but I think that I've told all the stories that I want to tell that way. And I actually tracked, like, she has a blog. I think the last time anything had been posted on it was 2012, but it was these beautiful pen and watercolor drawings of like fungi out in the woods and like skinks and like nature stuff, where she'd go out with her dog walking and sit down and do these beautiful drawings. But yeah, her website is mostly all illustration work. And so it sounds like that's what she's doing nowadays. Which, you know, like, it makes this stuff very precious to me.
It does.
You know, it's like, wow. And I like Summer of Love a lot. Daddy's Girl is really powerful, not just the storytelling, but, I mean, the drawing is so different. I mean, it's clearly the same artist, but it's just done in this, with different materials, and it has a very different effect, and it's really stark and beautiful. And it's you know, it's one of those things where it's like, God, I'd love to see another comic from you, you know. Yeah. But at the same time, I really appreciate that kind of point of view of like, I did these things and you know.
Well, Caitlin, because I know you more through your relationship to comics and not like, but you are also a cartoonist, right?
I don't really make comics anymore, but yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because like, are you sort of like not connect, but like, you had made comics, right? And you don't really make comics.
I have made comics, but I hadn't made them for very long, and I think that it's kind of hard for me to explain. I was trying to word it recently, but I think I just always wanted to be a part of comics, and I liked making the comics that I made, but it was never what I felt like I needed to do and what I was, like, meant to do. Okay. I just wanted to basically, in a way, just do what I'm doing now, which is, like, supporting comics and being part of it. I just didn't know how that was going to take form quite yet, you know? And the support role is so much more something that I think I get more out of it than I got out of actually making my own comics, you know? And,
okay.
You know, being creative in other ways is satisfying enough for me with other parts of my life and music and everything. But I think that, I mean, the thing with Debbie, just, like, talking about that, it's just, like, what a talent. Like, can you imagine putting out two pieces of work that like that, that some people would work their whole career to try to get to? And
yeah.
She's done that, and now she's doing something else totally different, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of believable.
Yeah, I mean, in a certain, I don't know why I feel this way, but it's also kind of admirable. I mean, it's just like, I think it shows a strong sense of self, you know, it's just like, you know.
And it just sounds like those were stories that needed to, they weren't even, and not that anything's forced necessarily, but those are things that came out of her in a very genuine way that needed to be told, and now she's going on and doing something different, you know, where it's you know, she wasn't struggling to find her muse for any of that, you know.
Yeah. If you're going to have a two book body of work, that's a pretty impeccable one to have.
Well, I'm glad we talked about it, because I don't think she's someone who gets talked about that much.
No, in fact, you know, I looked it up. I mean, it looks like Summer of Love has been out of print for a while, and it's easy enough to get copies of them, but I don't think they're widely available, either of her books, anymore. I'm not sure about Daddy's Girl. I know Fana did a reprint of it in hardcover, and maybe that was like 2008 or something. So, you know, that wasn't that long ago, but I don't know. I think they're two books that could continue to resonate with a lot of people, and it would be nice to have them more readily accessible.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's great that you picked these, Mike, and Debbie, if you're listening, we love you.
Yeah, come back.
Somebody should get in touch with her.
All right, so I think we'll wrap it up there. You guys are going to tell me about how to get the Nancy tattoo. And on that.
And, yeah, once the mic is off, that's
what I need to do.
That's information for only a select few.
There he is. Hey, buddy, how was your weekend? Yeah, mine was too short. Hey,